Chapter 13. Bruce woke with Charmaine leaning over the chair and tickling his nose. He was fully dressed, with his helmet and rifle on the floor beside him, and only his boots unlaced.
"You do not snore, Bruce," she congratulated him, laughing her small husky laugh. "That is a good thing."
He struggled up, dopey with sleep.
"What time is it?"
"Nearly 5 o'clock. I have breakfast for you in the kitchen."
"Where is Boussier?"
"He is dressing. Then he will start moving them down to the train."
"My mouth tastes as though a goat slept in it."
Bruce moved his tongue across his teeth, feeling the fur on them.
"Then I shall not kiss you good morning, mon capitaine."
She straightened up with the laughter still in her eyes.
"But your toilet requisites are in the kitchen. I sent one of your gendarmes to fetch them from the train. You can wash in the sink."
Bruce laced up his boots and followed her through into the kitchen, stepping over sleeping bodies on the way.
"There is no hot water," Charmaine apologized.
"That is the least of my worries." Bruce crossed to the table and opened his small personal pack, taking out his razor and soap and comb.
"I raided the chicken coop for you," Charmaine confessed. "There were only 2 eggs. How shall I cook them?"
"Soft-boiled. 1 minute." Bruce stripped off his jacket and shirt, went to the sink and filled it. He sluiced his face and lifted handfuls of water over his head, snorting with pleasure. Then he propped his shaving mirror above the taps and spread soap on his face. Charmaine came to sit on the draining board beside him and watched with frank interest.
"I will be sorry to see the beard go," she said. "It looked like the pelt of an otter. I liked it."
"Perhaps I will grow it for you one day," Bruce smiled at her.
"Your eyes are blue, Charmaine."
"It has taken you a long time to find that out," she said, and pouted dramatically. Her skin was silky and cool-looking, lips pale pink without makeup. Her dark hair, drawn back, emphasized the high cheekbones and the size of her eyes.
"In India, Sher means tiger," Bruce told her, watching her from the corner of his eye. Immediately she abandoned the pout and drew her lips up into a snarl.
Her teeth were small and very white, and only slightly uneven. Her eyes rolled wide and then crossed at an alarming angle. She growled. Taken by surprise, Bruce laughed and nearly cut himself.
"I cannot abide a woman who clowns before breakfast. It ruins my digestion," he laughed at her.
"Breakfast," said Charmaine, and uncrossed her eyes, jumped off the draining board and ran to the stove. "Only just in time," she checked her watch.
1 minute and 20 seconds. Will you forgive me?"
"This once only, never again." Bruce washed the soap off his face, dried and combed his hair, and came to the table. She had a chair ready for him.
"How much sugar in your coffee?"
3, please. Bruce chopped the top off his egg, and she brought the mug and placed it in front of him.
"I like making breakfast for you."
Bruce didn't answer her. This was dangerous talk. She sat down opposite him, leaned forward on her elbows with her chin in her hands.
"You eat too fast," she announced,
and Bruce raised an eyebrow.
"But at least you keep your mouth closed."
Bruce started on his second egg.
"How old are you?"
30, said Bruce.
"I'm 20, nearly 21.
A ripe old age."
"What do you do?"
"I'm a soldier," he answered.
"No, you're not."
"All right. I'm a lawyer."
"You must be clever," she said solemnly.
"A genius. That's why I'm here."
"Are you married?"
"No, I was."
"What is this? A formal interrogation? Is she dead?"
"No." He prevented the hurt from showing in his face. It was easier to do now.
"Oh," said Charmaine.
She picked up the teaspoon and concentrated on stirring his coffee.
"Is she pretty?"
"No."
"Yes, I suppose so."
"Where is she?" Then quickly, "I'm sorry, it's none of my business." Bruce took the coffee from her and drank it. Then he looked at his watch.
"It's nearly 5:15. I must go out and get Mike Haig."
Charmaine stood up quickly.
"I'm ready." I know the way. You'd better get down to the station.
I want to come with you.
Why?
Just because, that's why.
Searching for a reason.
I want to see the baby again.
You win. Bruce picked up his pack and they went through into the lounge. Boussier was there, dressed and efficient. His men were nearly ready to move.
Madame Cartier and I are going out to the mission to fetch the doctor. We'll be back in half an hour or so. I want all your people aboard by then.
Very well, Captain. Bruce called to Ruffy, who was standing on the veranda.
Did you load those supplies for the mission?
They're in the back of the Ford, boss.
Good. Bring all your sentries in and take them down to the station. Tell the engine driver to get steam up and keep his hand on the throttle. We'll shove off as soon as I get back with Lieutenant Haig.
Okay, boss.
Bruce handed him his pack. Take this down for me, Ruffy. Then his eyes fell on the large heap of cardboard cartons at Ruffy's feet.
What's that?
Ruffy looked a little embarrassed.
Couple of bottles of beer, boss. Thought we might get thirsty going home.
Good for you, grinned Bruce. Put them in a safe place and don't drink them all before I get back.
I'll save you one or two, promised Ruffy.
Come along, Tiger Girl.
And Bruce led Charmaine out to the Ford. She sat closer to him than the previous day, but with her legs curled up under her, as before. As they crossed the causeway, she lit two cigarettes and passed one to him.
I'll be glad to leave this place, she said, looking out across the swamp, with the mist lifting sluggishly off it in the dawn, hanging in grey shreds from the fluffy tops of the papyrus grass.
I've hated it here since Paul died. I hate the swamp and the mosquitoes and the jungle all around. I'm glad we're going.
Where will you go? Bruce asked.
I haven't thought about it. Back to Belgium, I suppose. Anywhere away from the Congo, away from this heat to a country where you can breathe, away from the disease and the fear. Somewhere so that I know tomorrow I will not have to run, where human life has meaning, away from the killing and the burning and the rape.
She drew on her cigarette almost fiercely, staring ahead at the green wall of the forest.
I was born in Africa, said Bruce. In the time when the judge's gavel was not the butt of an FN rifle, before you registered your vote with a burst of gunfire.
He spoke softly with regret. In the time before the hatred.
But now I don't know. I haven't thought much about the future either.
He was silent for a while. They reached the turn off to the mission, and he swung the Ford into it.
It has all changed so quickly. I hadn't realized how quickly until I came here to the Congo.
Are you going to stay here, Bruce? I mean, stay here in the Congo?
No, he said. I've had enough. I don't even know what I'm fighting for.
He threw the butt of his cigarette out of the window. Ahead of them were the mission buildings. Bruce parked the car outside the hospital buildings, and they sat together quietly.
There must be some other land, he whispered.
And if there is, I'll find it.
He opened the door and stepped out. Charmaine slid across the seat under the wheel and joined him. They walked side by side to the hospital. Her hand brushed his, and he caught it, held it, and felt the pressure of his fingers returned by hers. She was taller than his shoulder, but not much.
Mike Haig and Father Ignatius were together in the women's ward, too engrossed to hear the Ford arrive.
Good morning, Michael, called Bruce. What's the fancy dress for?
Mike Haig looked up and grinned.
Morning, Bruce. Hello, Charmaine.
Then he looked down at the faded brown cassock he wore.
Borrowed it from Ignatius. A bit long in the leg and tight round the waist, but less out of place in a sick ward than the accoutrements of war.
It suits you, Dr. Mike, said Charmaine.
Nice to hear someone call me that again. The smile spread all over Haig's face.
I suppose you want to see your baby, Charmaine.
Is he well?
Mother and child both doing fine, he assured her, and led Charmaine down between the row of beds, each with a black woolly head on the pillow and big curious eyes following their progress.
May I pick him up?
He's asleep, Charmaine.
Oh, please.
I doubt it will kill him. Very well, then.
"Bruce, come and look. Isn't he a darling?" She held the tiny black body to her chest, and the child snuffled, its mouth automatically starting to search. Bruce leaned forward to peer at it. "Very nice," he said, and turned to Ignatius. "I have those supplies I promised you. Will you send an orderly to get them out of the car?" Then to Mike Haig. "You'd better get changed, Mike. We're all ready to leave." Not looking at Bruce, fiddling with a stethoscope round his neck, Mike shook his head. "I don't think I'll be going with you, Bruce." Surprised, Bruce faced him. "What?" "I think I'll stay on here with Ignatius. He's offered me a job." "You must be mad, Mike." "Perhaps," agreed Haig, and took the infant from Shemaine, placed it back in the cradle beside its mother, and tucked the sheet in round its tiny body. And then again, "Perhaps not." He straightened up and waved a hand down the rows of occupied beds. "There's plenty to do here, that you must admit." Bruce stared helplessly at him, and then appealed to Shemaine. "Talk him out of it. Perhaps you can make him see the futility of it." Shemaine shook her head. "No, Bruce, I will not." "Mike, listen to reason, for God's sake. You can't stay here in this disease-ridden backwater. You can't." "I'll walk out to the car with you, Bruce. I know you're in a hurry." He led them out through the side door and stood by the driver's window of the Ford while they climbed in. Bruce extended his hand and Mike took it, gripping hard. "Cheerio, Bruce. Thanks for everything." "Cheerio, Mike. I suppose you'll be taking orders and having yourself made into a fully licensed dispenser of salvation." "I don't know about that, Bruce. I doubt it. I just want another chance to do the only work I know. I just want a last-minute rally to reduce the formidable score that's been chalked up against me so far." "I'll report you missing, believed, killed. Throw your uniform in the river," said Bruce. "I'll do that." Mike stepped back. "Look after each other, you two." "I don't know what you mean," Shemaine informed him primly, trying not to smile. "I'm an old dog, not easy to fool," said Mike. "Go to it with a will." Bruce let out the clutch and the Ford slid forward. "Godspeed, my children." That smile spread all over Mike's face as he waved. "Au revoir, Dr. Michael." "So long, Mike." Bruce watched him in the rearview mirror, tall in his ill-fitting cassock, something proud and worthwhile in his stance. He waved once more and then turned and hurried back into the hospital. Neither of them spoke until they had almost reached the main road. Shemaine nestled softly against Bruce, smiling to herself, looking ahead down the tree-lined passage of the road. "He's a good man, Bruce." "Light me a cigarette, please, Shemaine." He didn't want to talk about it. It was one of those things that can only be made grubby by words. Slowing for the intersection, Bruce dropped her into second gear, automatically glancing to his left to make sure the main road was clear before turning into it. "Oh, my God," he gasped. "What is it, Bruce?" Shemaine looked up with alarm from the cigarette she was lighting. "Look." 100 yards up the road, parked close to the edge of the forest, was a convoy of 6 large vehicles. The first 5 were heavy, canvas-canopied lorries, painted dull military olive. The 6th was a gasoline tanker in bright yellow and red, with the Shell Company insignia on the barrel-shaped body. Hitched behind the leading lorry was a squat, rubber-tired 25-pounder anti-tank gun, with its long barrel pointed jauntily skywards. Round the vehicles, dressed in an assortment of uniforms and different-styled helmets, were at least 60 men. They were all armed, some with automatic weapons and others with obsolete bolt-action rifles. Most of them were urinating carelessly into the grass that lined the road, while the others were standing in small groups, smoking and talking. "General Moses," said Shemaine, her voice small with the shock. "Get down," ordered Bruce, and with his free hand thrust her onto the floor. He rammed the accelerator flat, and the Ford roared out into the main road, swerving violently, the back end floating free in the loose dust as he held the wheel over. Correcting the skid, meeting it and straightening out, Bruce glanced at the rear-view mirror. Behind them, the men had dissolved into a confused pattern of movement. He heard their shouts high and thin above the racing engine of the Ford.
Bruce looked ahead. It was another 100 yards to the bend in the road that would hide them and take them down to the causeway across the swamp. Charmaine was on her knees, pulling herself up to look over the back of the seat. "Keep on the floor, damn you," shouted Bruce, and pushed her head down roughly. As he spoke, the roadside next to them erupted in a rapid series of leaping dust fountains, and he heard the high, hysterical beat of machine-gun fire. The bend in the road rushed towards them, just a few more seconds. Then, with a succession of jarring crashes that shook the whole body of the car, a burst of fire hit them from behind. The windscreen shattered into a sheet of opaque diamond lacework. The dashboard clock exploded, powdering Charmaine's hair with particles of glass. 2 bullets tore through the seat, ripping out the stuffing like the entrails of a wounded animal. "Close your eyes," shouted Bruce, and punched his fist through the windscreen. Slitting his own eyes against the chips of flying glass, he could just see through the hole his fist had made. The corner was right on top of them, and he dragged the steering wheel over it, skidding into it, his offside wheels bumping into the verge, grass and leaves brushing the side of the car. Then they were through the corner, and racing down towards the causeway. "Are you all right, Charmaine?"
"Yes, are you?"
She emerged from under the dashboard, a smear of blood across one cheek where the glass had scratched her, and her eyes bigger than ever with fright. "I only pray that Boussier and Hendry are ready to pull out. Those bastards won't be 5 minutes behind us." They went across the causeway with the needle of the speedometer touching 80, up the far side, and into the main street of Port Reprieve. Bruce thrust his hand down on the hooter ring, blowing urgent warning blasts. "Please, God, let them be ready," he muttered. With relief, he saw that the street was empty and the hotel seemed deserted. He kept blowing the horn as they roared down towards the station, a great billowing cloud of dust rising behind them. Braking the Ford hard, he turned it in past the station buildings and onto the platform. Most of Boussier's people were standing next to the train. Boussier himself was beside the last truck with his wife and the small group of women around him. Bruce shouted at them through the open window. "Get those women into the train. The Schufter are right behind us. We're leaving immediately." Without question or argument, old Boussier gathered them together and hurried them up the steel ladder into the truck. Bruce drove down the station platform, shouting as he went. "Get in, for Christ's sake. Hurry up. They're coming." He braked to a standstill next to the cab of the locomotive and shouted up at the bald head of the driver. "Get going. Don't waste a second. Give her everything she's got. There's a bunch of Schufter not 5 minutes behind us." The driver's head disappeared into the cab without even the usual polite, "Oui, monsieur." "Come on, Charmaine." Bruce grabbed her hand and dragged her from the car. Together they ran to one of the covered coaches, and Bruce pushed her halfway up the steel steps. At that moment, the train jerked forward so violently that she lost her grip on the handrails and tumbled backwards on top of Bruce. He was caught off balance, and they fell together in a heap on the dusty platform. Above them, the train gathered speed, pulling away. He remembered this nightmare from his childhood, running after a train and never catching it. He had to fight down his panic as he and Charmaine scrambled up, both of them panting, clinging to each other, the coaches clackety-clacking past them, the rhythm of their wheels mounting. "Run!" he gasped. "Run!" And with the panic weakening their legs, he just managed to catch the handrail of the second coach. He clung to it, stumbling along beside the train, one arm round Charmaine's waist. Sergeant Major Ruffarero leaned out, took Charmaine by the scruff of her neck, and lifted her in like a lost kitten. Then he reached down for Bruce. "Boss, someday we're going to lose you if you go on playing around like that." "I'm sorry, Bruce," she panted, leaning against him. "No damage done," he could grin at her. "Now I want you to get into that compartment and stay there until I tell you to come out. Do you understand?"
"Yes, Bruce."
"Off you go." He turned from her to Ruffy. "Up onto the roof, Sergeant Major. We're going to have fireworks. Those Schufter have got a field gun with them, and we'll be in full view of the town right up to the top of the hills." By the time they reached the roof of the train, it had pulled out of Port Reprieve and was making its first angling turn up the slope of the hills. The sun was up now, well clear of the horizon, and the mist from the swamp had lifted so that they could see the whole village spread out beneath them. General Moses' column had crossed the causeway and was into the main street. As Bruce watched, the leading truck swung sharply across the road and stopped. Men boiled out from under the canopy and swarmed over the field gun, unhitching it, manhandling it into position. "I hope those Arabs haven't had any drill on that piece," grunted Ruffy. "We'll soon find out," Bruce assured him grimly, and looked back along the train. In the last truck, Bussier stood protectively over the small group of four women and their children, like an old white-haired collie with its sheep. Crouched against the steel side of the truck, André de Sourier and half a dozen gendarmes were swinging and sighting the two Bren guns. In the second truck, also, the gendarmes were preparing to open fire. "What are you waiting for?" roared Ruffy. "Get me that field gun! Start shooting!" They fired a ragged volley. Then the Bren guns joined in. With every burst, André's helmet slipped forward over his eyes, and he had to stop and push it back. Lying on the roof of the leading coach, Wally Hendry was firing short, business-like bursts. The shufter round the field gun scattered, leaving one of their number lying in the road. But there were men behind the armour shield. Bruce could see the tops of their helmets. Suddenly, there was a long gush of white smoke from the barrel, and the shell rushed over the top of the train with a noise like the wings of a giant pheasant. "Over," said Ruffy. "Under," to the next shot as it ploughed into the trees below them. "And the third one right up the throat," said Bruce. But it hit the rear of the train. They were using armour-piercing projectiles, not high explosive, for there was not the burst of yellow cordite fumes, but only the crash and jolt as it struck. Anxiously, Bruce tried to assess the damage. The men and women in the rear trucks looked shaken, but unharmed, and he started a sigh of relief, which changed quickly to a gasp of horror as he realized what had happened. "They've hit the coupling," he said. "They've sheared the coupling on the last truck." Already, the gap was widening, as the rear truck started to roll back down the hill, cut off like the tail of a lizard. "Jump!" screamed Bruce, cupping his hands round his mouth. "Jump before you gather speed!" Perhaps they did not hear him. Perhaps they were too stunned to obey. But no one moved. The truck rolled back faster and faster as gravity took it, down the hill towards the village and the waiting army of General Moses.
"What can we do, boss?"
"Nothing," said Bruce. The firing round Bruce had petered out into silence, as every man, even Wally Hendry, stared down the slope at the receding truck. With a constriction of his throat, Bruce saw old Bussier stoop and lift his wife to her feet, hold her close to his side, and the two of them looking back at Bruce on the roof of the departing train. Bussier raised his right hand in a gesture of farewell, and then he dropped it again and stood very still. Behind him, André de Sourier had left the Bren gun and removed his helmet. He also was looking back at Bruce, but he did not wave. At intervals, the field gun in the village punctuated the stillness with its deep boom and gush of smoke, but Bruce hardly heard it. He was watching the shufter running down towards the station yard to welcome the truck. Losing speed, it ran into the platform and halted abruptly as it hit the buffers at the end of the line. The shufter swarmed over it like little black ants over the body of a beetle, and faintly Bruce heard the pop, pop, pop of their rifles, saw the low sun glint on their bayonets. He turned away. They had almost reached the crest of the hills. He could feel the train increasing speed under him, but he felt no relief, only the prickling at the corners of his eyes and the ache of it trapped in his throat. "The poor bastards," growled Ruffy beside him. "The poor bastards." And then there was another crashing jolt against the train, another hit from the field gun, this time up forward on the locomotive. Shriek of escaping steam, the train checking its pace, losing power. But they were over the crest of the hills, the village was out of sight, and gradually the train speeded up again as they started down the back slope. But steam spouted out of it,
hissing white jets of it, and Bruce knew they had received a mortal wound. He switched on the radio.
"Driver, can you hear me? How bad is it?"
"I cannot see, Captain. There is too much steam, but the pressure on the gauge is dropping swiftly. Use all you can to take us down the hill. It's imperative that we pass the level crossing before we halt. It is absolutely imperative. If we stop this side of the level crossing, they'll be able to reach us with their lorries."
"I will try, Captain."
They rocketed down the hills, but as soon as they reached the level ground, their speed began to fall off. Peering through the dwindling clouds of steam, Bruce saw the pale brown ribbon of road ahead of them, and they were still travelling at a healthy 30 miles an hour as they passed it. When finally the train trickled to a standstill, Bruce estimated that they were 3 or 4 miles beyond the level crossing, safely walled in by the forest and hidden from the road by 3 bends.
"I doubt if they'll find us here, but if they do, they'll have to come down the line from the level crossing to get at us.
We'll go back a mile and lay an ambush in the forest on each side of the line," said Bruce.
"Those Arabs won't be following us, boss. They've got themselves women and a whole bar full of liquor. Be 2 or 3 days before old General Moses can sober them up enough to move them on."
"You're probably right, Ruffy. But we'll take no chances. Get that ambush laid, and then we'll try and think up some idea for getting home."
Suddenly a thought occurred to him. Martin Bussier had the diamonds with him. They'd not be too pleased about that in Elizabethville. Almost immediately Bruce was disgusted with himself. The diamonds were by far the least important thing that they had left behind in Port Reprieve.